Arias Medical Group is a leading healthcare staffing agency offering full-time travel and direct hire career opportunities for physical therapists nationwide. An exciting career is waiting for you. Dream it and live it with Arias. To learn more, call 1-800-340-2619.
This is the PT Pintcast, a podcast that talks about physical therapy over beer, bringing together clinicians, researchers, and forward-thinking PTs in a show that's anything but boring.
Let there be beer!
This is the PT Pintcast with your host, Jimmy McKay.
Here we go with another episode of the PT Pintcast. The best conversations happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours. Want to welcome on board our newest sponsor, Arias Staffing. Check out their link on our website, ptpintcast.com. Our guest tonight was raised by wolves in upstate New York, did his clinical training at West Virginia University and his research training at the University of Pittsburgh. He spent the last 14 years at the University of Florida teaching evidence-based practice and researching musculoskeletal pain, transitioning this summer to Duke University to direct clinical research in the Department of Orthopedics and the Duke Clinical Research Institute. His most recent accolades include the 2016 Golden Pen Award and the Maley Lecture. Tonight on the PT Pintcast, please welcome Steve George. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. It seems appropriate with the upstate New York shout out to acknowledge the Maine Endwell Little League World Series
team. Yeah.
We're up not too far away from them, and they were a common high school opponent. So it was great to see them win it all, and a lot of people talking about that part of the world. Very well done by Maine Endwell.
Yeah. So where was the Wolfpack from, and where in upstate New York?
I graduated from Ithaca High School. My folks still live in Elmira. We kind of went back and forth between Elmira, Horseheads, even Big Flats, if you're in a specialty of that area.
Yeah.
But I'm a Ithaca High graduate. Still try to get up there once or twice a year.
Yeah, no, I did my my undergraduate work at St. Bonaventure University. So, you know, Western New York, and I drove through all those towns that you just mentioned, going from where I'm from in Orange County, New York, to Western New York.
Especially in the fall, that ride is really beautiful.
But yeah, good part of the country. So when I saw that in your bio, Wolfpack raised in upstate New York, I was like, another guy like me from upstate New York. So, right. Hey, congratulations on the two accolades recently, 2016 Golden Pen and the Maley Lecture. Those are two big deals, and you got them pretty much back-to-back in the same year.
Yeah, thank you. I guess in this case, lightning did strike twice. Luckily, it didn't strike me. But no, obviously very honored and very humbled. I think it just happened to be one of those really weird timing things where two separate groups of people are working towards nominating things. And it's very humbled to know that people appreciate the work that you're doing and actually think that it's worthy enough to be recognized at a high level. And you know, I think hopefully that's a sign that we're doing rigorous work, because I always say we, it's not just me, and I think everyone who's familiar with research, but in case your listeners aren't, but it's a team sport, and I've had great PhD students, I've had great mentors, I have great collaborators. We could take 45 minutes and list them all, but when you look at what we've written, it makes it fun too, and it gives you different points of view, people that challenge you, people that push you. This year just happened to be my year to be the one to be recognized, but it definitely, a lot of people shared in that, and you know, it was great.
Well, you started off your Maley Lecture by mentioning, I mean, you went through name by name, you know, calling them out if they were in the audience to stand and be recognized. So that just shows that you stand behind what you just said. It is a team effort, and you were excited to mention every one of those people's names and give them credit.
All those folks gave their time. And one of the things we had at the University of Florida, it was just very open. People were willing to speak their mind. And it's amazing when you take what you have in your head and you share it. So I thought it was important to let those folks know how much I thought that was the least I could do.
That's cool. I mean, it makes it part of the team element. Well, I want to thank Boddington's Pub Ale tonight, because that's what I'm drinking this evening. See if I can get that on there. There we go. As it foams up all over the floor. Good. So we try to have a different beer on each episode, and that's what we're going with tonight, all the way from Great Britain. So let's jump into it. Just had Kara Lewis on the show not long ago, and she gave the McMillan Lecture. What's it just like to be up there in front of your colleagues, your field. What's it like up there when you're in the middle of it and you're delivering your message? How's that feel?
First of all, when you're in the middle of it, it feels great, because when you're in the middle of it, you're kind of beyond the thinking about what it all means.
No more so thought. It's just muscle memory.
Yeah. So once you get past that, and of course you want to acknowledge the people who are supporting the award, and the Maley Lecture has very generous support from the Maley family. I think it's kind of a unique opportunity to talk about a professional issue. I mean, basically, about 13 months before I did that, I get a call from Sharon Dunn, who's the president, and said, guess what?
That's going to be a cool call.
Yeah, it is. It is. But, you know, it's very open-ended. They said, we'd like you to talk about pain. You hang up and say, great, yeah, that's awesome. And then you say, oh, it's like the gift that keeps on giving. You know, I told her I'd almost rather she call me May with only a month to prepare.
Right. First of all, the John H.P. Maley Lecture Award nominees have made a distinguished contribution to the profession of physical therapy in any area. That's like winning an award at the Olympics. It's everybody. I mean, you're technically competing against everybody, but that's 13 months in advance, and they said pain. And then, of course, the APTA launches their hashtag ChoosePT campaign a month and a half, 2 months before you give your lecture. That's great timing right there.
Yeah, and I thank Sharon for doing that for me.
I mean, she really sets you up. I mean, literally, they just picked a topic and said, hey, we want you to talk about this. And by the way, we're going to put our entire weight behind it. Just exactly. In front of your speech.
It's like them asking me to throw a strike, but getting to start 5 feet from the pin,
right,
instead of, I mean, the timing, I don't know what to say about the timing. That's that old thing about the intersection of preparation and lucky, because, you know, obviously the profession had to have someone who was able to put something together and had lived in the pain space for a little while. I mean, I think one of the things with PTs, this kind of being a hot topic right now, they have to realize there are folks that have been doing research in this area and thinking about this for many, many years. And to be able to get to this point took some time. So other physical therapists, I think, are going to be absorbing this information at a pretty fast rate, because it's easy to play catch up.
Right.
You know, the moving forward part is when people are going to have to be patient, or I'm really interested to see if this generates a new era of pain researchers, or if it becomes just a real, you know, a popularity contest, or and people like to talk about it, but they don't really
do anything about it.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into talking about pain then, because it's something that's so easy to understand until you get into it and realize it's not easy to understand. It's pretty complex. It's going to be complex, as you mentioned, from patient to patient. Variability in pain. I thought your use of the tattoo artist and the pain scientist, and if someone hasn't seen the Maley Lecture with Steve talking about it, I thought it was great that we can understand something but maybe not know why, and just see how variable pain can actually be. And we'll put the link to that Maley Lecture. You should check it out at ptpinecast.com. But variability in pain, talk a little bit about what that means to you.
So one of the things, my origin story really relates to working clinically and then getting into a research career. When I finished my PhD, you start looking around and say, what am I going to do next? And just like you're doing right now, by the way,
yeah.
You know, what am I going to do next?
What am I going to do next? Start working a week.
Yeah, it never ends. So when I started to have to thinking about, you know, working in a week, I wanted to do a postdoc to gain some additional research experience. So I flew down to the University of Florida and met some researchers that worked in quantitative sensory testing. And it was really fascinating to me because remember, this is in 2002. As a physical therapist, I had spent my whole career measuring pain. And then my dissertation was really focused on treating pain, or, you know, lessening pain. And then I meet these folks who are causing pain with standard stimulus as a way to study pain. And it really, really got me hooked, because all my career, pain had two sources of variability, and it was the input and the output. And if you don't control either of those, you don't know what is what, which is why people were so frustrated with it. Well, here is a way to control the input. I could give everyone, there were different protocols, but I could give everyone essentially the same nociceptive dose, if you want to think of that.
And how did you do that? How could you make sure that was the same thing?
So we had, and there's a gazillion ways to do this, but the techniques that I really caught on to were with a thermal probe. You can control the temperature.
Okay.
You can randomly give people series of temperatures and have them rate them. What you start seeing then, so I spent 2 years basically doing this in the basement of the research complex at the University of Florida. I knew the temperatures were exactly the same. And I knew that. And we, of course, didn't let the participants know this. And sometimes the participants were patients. Sometimes they were healthy subjects. It ended up, it really doesn't matter a whole lot because the variability is the same. And someone would rate, I would give them, you know, they got train number 7 and it was random, this. Somebody would rate it as 80 out of 100. Someone else would rate it as 20 out of 100. Someone else would rate it as 0 because it hadn't hit their threshold yet. And it got me thinking, this really makes it hard to find what the right answer is because I'm doing this, I'm controlling it, they're rating it, they're not trying to lie, they're not trying to cheat. We do things to make sure they're not arbitrarily guessing stuff. So if the person who rates it as 80, we can look at their other ratings. And when we compare it to the person who's 40, their ratings are generally going to be higher, but they're in the right order. Their 80 stimulus may matches with the temperature that was the highest for them. There's a rhyme and reason to it, but it is at a very individual level. And then when you start graphing it, and that's, you know, the graph that I used in the Mailey lecture is one that I've found to be very helpful when talking to clinical audiences. And it just shows with one stimulus, people are going to use the whole scale. In my mind, historically, in the past, we would blame that variability on the patient because we would have in our minds that this temperature should be between, let's say, 40 and 60. Like if you rate it between 40 and 60, that's what it should be.
That's normal.
Yeah. And if you're higher than that, it's your fault.
Right.
And if it's lower than that, it's your fault too, but we don't see you because you're not seeking
right.
healthcare.
So what I just want to bring up, what if you would see that, if it's higher than it should be, if you're saying this temperature should cause between a 40 and a 60 and somebody says 80, are we thinking that patient is lying? And that's got to be one of the first things that crosses your mind, or they're too sensitive. That's got to be two things that you think of, right? Or this person's trying to get care and they shouldn't be. They can't possibly be feeling an 8 out of 10 or an 80 out of 100 because that's not what we expect.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's a common question from clinicians, especially. And what my experience has taught me is we just can't tell. Like, I really got away from being judgmental at all. I mean, I really, to me, it became a way of this is how this person is expressing their experience to me. We're asking them to express it in a numeric rating, and they're letting me know that it's an intense experience. I ask them to rate it on a pain intensity scale, and if they're using the higher end, and they need to let me know that they're having a very intense experience. Now, in the lab setting, it's pretty easy. It's related to the heat. But in the clinical setting, the challenge is it could mean anything from they need to go to the emergency room because something is blown up inside of them to I don't like my job. I don't want to go back to it. But I don't think of it ever as conscious lying. There are folks that can do that. And when I've talked to other people about that, that's the realm of medico-legal. Those decisions are not made typically by the physical therapist. And I've talked to our students and I've talked to clinicians about this. If you want to write something in a note, you can note the ratings, you can note if they're consistent or inconsistent. But if you start going down the realm of saying this person is malingering or lying, you better be prepared to be able to swear an oath in court and tell them exactly how that was determined. And I can tell you, I don't know how to determine that. I mean, that takes many more pieces of the puzzle than what we see clinically.
We're talking about biolegal, and also now it brings up biopsychosocial. In your example with the tattoo artist, you mentioned that somebody who has a tattoo that they're getting done, and it has to do with a happy occasion, maybe the birth of a child, the pain rating typically experienced from a tattoo needle, which is a consistent nociceptive input, is typically lower.
They did the postdoc. They did the same damn postdoc that I did, but for a completely different reason.
Yeah.
And so sorry, go on.
I was gonna say, and then the opposite was also true by this guy who was just a tattoo artist, but is backed up by neuroscience pain scientists, which if the tattoo is meant to represent something that's negative, maybe the death of a loved one, the pain is typically higher. I mean, which inputs, if what you're saying, if the person doesn't want to go back to work and they experience more pain when lifting and their job requires lifting, that's actually viable. That's along that line where they will experience more pain because they're thinking about that job they hate that sucks they don't want to go back to.
Definitely. That story, that's one of those things. It really did happen and it really did blow my mind. I thought, man, first of all, this guy had a lot more fun learning
delivering pain than you did in the basement.
Did. Yeah. You know, he came to some of the same conclusions without, you know, having to learn statistics and, you know, run analyses and publish papers. But it was really interesting. I mean, coincidentally, it was at a pain meeting. I happened to go consult him for something outside of the meeting. He started doing his work and we just started talking, and he said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm here for a conference." And he said, "Oh, what conference is it?" And I told him it was the American Pain Society. And then we just started talking, and it was fascinating. He said all of those things about, you know, a lot of this is really depends. And then, you know what I noticed? You know, the mood really has something to do with it. That's probably even more than the location. When I left that, it took me a little while to process it. But you know, really, I got to thinking, and you mentioned this earlier, this guy knows a lot more than most healthcare providers do about pain. Most people, I don't think, would get that. You know, they would say, of course, my orthopedic surgeon, of course, my physical therapist, of course, this person knows more about it than a tattoo artist. And you know, now I don't know. I think the traditional training most people get would not lead you to have the same answers that Maddie has.
Right, which is why I was excited to have you on the show, because I was talking with one of my former classmates for a while, actually. She, in clinic, had been seeing some chronic pain patients, and with her CI on her last rotation, didn't really know what to make of it. I think a lot of the pain education that we get in PT school was, well, pain is the result of an input. It's an output of an input. But you even brought that up with some of your diagrams in your lecture, which is that's not always the case. So in terms of current concepts of pain, if you were going to describe to a first-year PT student, so someone who wants to understand what it is, what is pain?
You know, we have to acknowledge that pain is a sensation. It starts as a sensation. Otherwise, I think, you know, that creates a little bit of problem in our field. It is linked to an injury. There is some input. I don't think it just, I understand there's psychogenic pain, but my colleagues, my psychological colleagues tell me that that's very rare. And usually those people are really good and we probably wouldn't pick them up. Like, you know, it's pretty tricky. Okay. But for me, I would tell them it usually starts with a sensation, but it's an open-ended sensation that is very highly prioritized by our nervous system. Our other sensations, I don't think, are as open-ended, like vision and hearing and taste and smell and touch and all of that. I think, and if you think about it, in neuroanatomy, we used to teach pain like that. You know, it had two tracks it goes
That's
on.
It, yeah.
And if you block the spinothalamic and if you block the other one, I don't even remember them all that much anymore, because I think one of the things all the studies have shown is that, like, if you cut the optic tracts, that person's not going to see.
Right.
If you cut, you know, the auditory, that person's not going to hear. But pain is very resilient, and it is coded all over. It's got redundancy out the wazoo. If you look in the brain, you know, they do those imaging studies, which I think are fascinating. But all they really do is reinforce that pain is a cortical experience, and it is experienced throughout the brain, even in the cerebellum. They show activity to prepare for early movement. So I would let them know it's a sensation, but it's a different sensation because it is open-ended and it is coded for all over them. And then I think the last part I would add, which, and I like this term, and I can't remember exactly who brought this up because it wasn't me, it is related to an emotional homeostasis too. And that's where, is it a sensation? Is it an emotion? And it's both. But it also, you know, that experience is really driven by that emotional homeostasis. And when we think of a physiological homeostasis, you know, we think of cell membranes and what's on one side versus the other. But I think pain is more closely linked to the emotional homeostasis.
Does that mean it's more animalistic? I mean, since you'd mentioned if you cut the optic tract, you can't see, but you really can't get rid of pain. We can't get rid of it. Does that mean it's maybe more important to our survival since we're just basically animals than the other senses?
I think it might be. I mean, I think first of all the senses are really important, right? The issue is some of them maybe had to be very specific to be that successful. You know, vision maybe had to be contained the way it is in order for us to process it efficiently. Pain, if you think of it, it's kind of the other way around. It is almost, it could probably benefit from some specificity because it is processed everywhere. And the alert system is sometimes, you know, so a lot of people think that is a major problem. So I do think there is an animalistic part, but I think the part that perpetuates it into chronicity is probably not as animalistic. And I think if you think of it in evolutionary standard, and even in industrial versus non-industrial, there does seem to be a key link to societies that are willing to stay active and move around. Those type of things override that initial protective.
You mean like a society who is moving, you know, maybe an Aborigine tribe who's always moving, they have less pain like that, like less chronic pain? they're not going to experience it.
Well, I think this is where it gets tricky, because the way they defined it and the way, you know, the non-Aboriginal might define it a little bit differently. But yeah, I think there is some evidence that chronic musculoskeletal pain is an industrialized epidemic of industrialized societies. And some people think that's because of the work that we do. Some people think that's because of the stresses that we do.
Psychological stresses.
Yeah, yeah. And I agree. And I also think it's because we don't have to go out and hunt for our food as much. When you think of a lot of musculoskeletal pain, it isn't immediately life-threatening. It's a nuisance. It gets in the way of things. I'm not downplaying it. But we also live in societies where it doesn't impact your basic survival anymore. Getting a little bit out there, but we're speculating here. But, you know, that's kind of how I think of it in evolutionary terms. When you think of, is it advantageous to be reactive to pain? It probably was a lot more beneficial 10, 15,000 years ago.
Right. And less advantageous now when you're trying to sit in your cubicle or, you know, drive your car for a long road trip. Now it's more of a nuisance and less of a thing that will keep you alive.
Yeah, or you have your healthcare provider telling you it's an indicator of damage or something that's wrong. Like, maybe that messaging isn't great either. Or you see how many commercials on TV telling you there's like these red arrows flashing and I need to take this, and this gives me 12 hours relief. Well, this one gives me 16 hours relief. Well, this one gives me 20 hours relief.
They're not talking about the why.
That's definitely the societal part of it. That is really interesting, really hard to measure, really hard to study, because then it's out there. But people, you know, that is really, I think a lot of people are drifting and beginning to look at that spousal interaction messaging that you get from different people, whether it's support people or the public in general. You know, that's going to have an influence on it.
Since you are in the Department of Orthopedics at Duke, a chronic pain patient, a patient that's been coming to PT, and maybe they're passed around the healthcare system for a while, because a lot of times pain patients, nobody knows where to send them. I tried some stuff. It didn't work. I moved them over here to PT. What does PT need to do if they just keep coming back to PT? I was talking about this with a colleague, and they had seen patients who just kept coming back because they wanted relief. Maybe they got a little bit with PT. But what's our duty as PTs in that situation?
I think as physical therapists, with the person that already has chronic pain, we definitely need to look at things that cause symptomatic relief because they're out there. We need to educate the patient that they're short-term. They're probably not provider dependent. And then we need to get more comfortable with self-management approaches, getting into management models. You know, one of the common management models that is suggested for something like chronic pain is diabetes, you know, where someone is going to have this for the rest of their life and they need to be taught how to manage it. They need to know what their resources are when it's out of control. But most of it is put on the individual nowadays. As physical therapists, I'm not saying that's the one, but I think conceptually that may be how we have to start thinking. And instead of seeing someone for 6 visits in 6 weeks, maybe think of 6 visits over 2 years. How would I see this person? And that, of course, means that's differences in reimbursement and all that. But, you know, that's for bigger and smarter people to figure out.
But, I think that's what PT needs to and should do in a lot of different cases, which is make sure the patient isn't a member of the team. They need to be in charge of the team in terms of getting their own care and taking ownership of it. I don't have a magic touch. I might not be able to make you feel better, but we as a patient and therapist have a chance to make you feel better.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that I thought was important and is that zero pain is not the goal idea, because I think physical therapists, if we're stereotyping our profession, you know, we're the optimistic people in healthcare. Like, you can do this. You're going to make your goals.
We can push it.
Yeah. And I think sometimes we do that to our own detriment, because you take someone and you say, yeah, I'm going to get them to zero pain. And that's how you end up in this situation where, you know, who is going to be the person in the healthcare system to have the honest conversation with the person? You know, you're probably not going to get to 0 out of 10 pain, but you can have manageable levels. You can function at a very high level. It's going to hurt, but that hurt isn't indicative of tissue damage or injury. We'll show you how to differentiate between those two. And oh, by the way, I don't think you need to be strung out on narcotics or opioids to do it. I think actually most people have a pretty good modulatory system. Maybe you'll need some NSAIDs or things when you get a flare up. Those are the type of conversations physical therapists need to have, not come to me I'll find the magic muscle length imbalance that has led to 60 years of pain for you, and we'll stretch it, and it'll all of a sudden you're not going to have it.
And you only know, I can do it.
Right, yeah. Or I'm going to find the misaligned part of whatever, and I'll do a muscle energy or manual therapy. Those will give you some relief, and I think it's great. Everyone likes to go to a provider and get some relief. But if you start tracing these people over a year, sometimes that relief is associated with the provider, sometimes it's not. It's hard to tell what is part of the normal kind of trajectory versus what is something that is definitely being changed by the physical therapist.
Right. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about one of the most telling and I think profound quotes of what I pulled out of your Mailey lecture. I want to get into that. And then the definition of pain science. I want to match that up with a different talk that I had heard not too long ago at one of the National Student Conclaves. We're going to do that on the other side of the break. Don't move. It's the PT Pinecast.
We talk PT, drink beer, and record it. This is the PT Pinecast.
Thought about a career as a traveling physical therapist? Arias Medical Group is a leading healthcare staffing agency offering full-time travel and direct hire career opportunities for PTs nationwide. Whether you're a new graduate or seasoned therapist, an exciting career is waiting for you. Dream it and live it with Arias. To learn more, call 1-800-340-2619 or visit ariasmedical.com. That's A-U-R-E-U-S medical.com.
Working at his orbicularis oris until failure. DJ, Jimmy McKay on the PT Pinecast.
And we're back on the PT Pinecast talking with Steve George, hot off his Mailey lecture. I saw a presentation on pain not long ago with a guy named Corey Zimney, had him on the show about 40 or 50 episodes ago. And the presentation was, hurt doesn't always mean harm. It's pain is not a thing. And he gave a good analogy, and I wanted to run the analogy by you because I've been using it with patients, and I want to know if you think it's good or not, if I should continue to do that. He gave an analogy like this. If you cut your arm with a knife, it's going to hurt. So you've damaged tissue there. The pain is showing that there is actual damage, okay? You bandage that up, and a week later you come back, and I go to poke it, and it's still sensitive. Now, your body is telling you there's pain there, but my finger touching where your arm is cut is not actually causing any damage. That's where Corey kind of explained it to me, where hurt doesn't always mean harm. That's where I think the difference is with a lot of perceptions on pain, and that's kind of what we're talking about here a lot, is that perception of what pain is, especially amongst physical therapists, it's not always the same thing from patient to patient. So is that a good analogy to use? Is that kind of consistent with more patient education or how we should approach talking with a patient about what they're experiencing and the why?
Yeah, I think actually, as long as you're not recreating it like in,
I have not cut anybody yet, I swear.
Yeah, it's probably good you don't cut yourself either, for the record. I think what is fascinating about this is when you talk to all these researchers, distilling these experiences down to narratives that patients can understand is challenging, because for some people, I think they're going to pick up on that one right away. I could see some patients questioning that because of the injury model. I'm a researcher, so I'm going to talk like a researcher, right? The cut is obvious and the source is obvious.
Okay, but, I can see that.
You know, when they come to you, they have like this MRI or something that...
unobvious, they can't see it.
Yeah, okay, I think as long as you're kind of following up on that and seeing how they think about it, because you don't want them to only understand that one.
Okay.
But I will agree with Corey that I think one of the key things when you're talking with patients, and we do these in some of our patient education, and you can kind of see it with some of the cognitive behavioral techniques that we do with like graded exposure, is when the patients start disassociating pain and injury, it really is powerful for them.
Talk about what you mean by that for a second, because I think I understand what you mean. Let me just tell you what I think you mean. This way I can feel a little bit smarter. When you start to dissociate pain and injury, so if I move my leg like this, it hurts at my hip. But if you're explaining to me, and I eventually believe that by moving it, I'm not causing damage,
right?
Then I will now understand that me moving isn't harming me, but it is still hurting me.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things that is common in back pain, and I talked about this in the lecture, but this is why we used it as an example. I work with Jason Benachak, Carol Greco, and Mike Schneider at Pitt on psychologically informed practice principles for physical therapists. And one of the key things is, you know, and it's specific to back pain, but I think it can be applied to everyone. But for this particular study, we're recruiting people with acute back pain. Classically, someone with acute back pain, they would come in, if they start moving their back around and it, they say it hurts more, we would say, okay, we're going to hold off today because you're in acute episode. Well, that might be like the worst thing you can do for someone who has high fear and is catastrophizing, is very anxious, because now you've sent into a message. It. Whoa, this hurt and my PT told me to stop. The underlying current is I need to be pain-free to move again.
Right.
These are geared towards people where they're psychologically, their preset is to avoid the movement, to try to lessen the movement, to lessen the pain. And when you see them, my favorite time, and I haven't worked with patients a lot, but I've done enough, when they have more pain and the normal move is to keep their exercise the same or to decrease it. But now you've reevaluated them. And yeah, maybe they came in at 4 out of 10 and they're at 6 out of 10 after their session. Because remember, they're acute and we're moving them. But, you know, they don't have drop foot. They don't have a neuro, you know, obvious. And you say, hey, you did great. You did everything we wanted to today. We're going to progress you next time. When they come back, the stereotypical thing I remember is, you know what? That was sore for like 12, 24 hours afterwards. But, you know, then I got back down to my baseline and it wasn't so bad. And I'm back here for more. And, you know, I think you're right. You know, I think I can do a little bit more. And invariably, then the pain levels start reducing. And that is an experiential way for them to understand then that increased pain didn't cause them more injury. And for some reason, it's intuitive in a lot of body regions. You know, when you work out pretty hard, like in the muscle, you expect to be sore for up to 48, 72 hours, and then you're okay with it. We don't think, but there's something that seems to go on when, you know, when it's more joint or if it's in the spine or the neck, people are just a little less willing to do that. That's a long-winded way of saying, I like that. I think you need to have a few more, and I think you have to be really aware of the patient who's going
to
be really
saying it to. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really point. Literally say, well, that's a great story for a cut, but I got a rotator cuff tear.
Right. I like that. Okay, cool. Know your audience. And that's kind of like, that should be on your mind, you know, all the time when you're in front of a patient too, is know who you're talking to.
Right.
What should PTs know about pain that we don't get it out of school? Because as I mentioned before we hit record here, I'm starting my first job in a week. What's one thing I should definitely keep in mind about pain specifically as I go out and go into that place that's scary called the real world?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question. We kind of talked about it. I can't remember if we were on the air or off about, you know, how there used to be all these discrete pathways and pain is open-ended. So I think one of the things is you can flush away most of the neuroscience related to pain.
Good.
And, you know, it's not like you're going to figure out the lesion like it's a stroke and, you know, and you're going to get the neurology the year award. The result of that is I think you have to understand that you're interacting with them on a behavioral level about pain. It's not a sensation right now. You know, it's not an emotion, right? You are interacting with them at a behavioral level on pain.
What do you mean by that?
I'll give you an example from my back in the day when I practiced in the 90s. One of the things that were really red hot was Waddle's non-organic sign.
Okay.
And one of the things you're supposed to look for, like, you know, you can do axial compression on someone with back pain. And if they say their back hurts, like that was supposed to be an indication of magnified illness behavior. You could do a straight leg raise on their back and then have them sitting and extend their leg. And if the patient knew it was supposed to hurt on their back, this was kind of a blame the patient type of approach. And right, the people who developed it,
Waddle signs was the thing to rule in malingering, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, not direct. There's an interesting history, and I've had one of the great thrills of my career is to have met and worked with Chris Main now, and he was involved with the Waddles. He worked with that group. They link that to this wonderful term of magnified illness behavior, but people jumped that shark and took it right to malingering. So I used to kind of, I could find those, and I could watch the person who was walking in the clinic with no antalgic gait, and when they got in the clinic, started,
limping.
So then I've been brainwashed, you know, through my own experiences. And now I'm thinking what we're seeing is a behavior. And the behavior is I have one shot to let this person know that I hurt and it interferes a lot with my life. So what choice do I have? You know, we do run into some people who are stoic, but most people, when they have a chance to let a healthcare provider know, you know, they are going to behave very differently than when the healthcare provider is not there. And we used to kind of, like I said, say that's an inconsistency. But now I just view it as this is this person's pain behavior when they're in front of me. And since I'm supposed to help them, they're probably going to behave differently than when they don't think someone is watching them who's going to help them. So things like bending forward, that's a behavior. People, that's also a way to measure lumbar range of motion. And what they teach you in PT school is that will tell you what their active range of motion is through their lumbar spine. I can tell you, I look at it, this is their behavior. This is their willingness to bend forward. And I can think my job is to stretch the hell out of their hamstrings so they can bend further. But I can tell you, you're going to get people more willing to bend further if you talk to them a little bit and say, you know, why aren't you bending further? And, well, it hurts. I'm worried I'm going to blow out some more discs and da-da-da, you know, and then you can talk to them about that. Same with stopping exercise because of pain is a behavior, okay? So that's what I would tell you is, you know, you get the good neuroscience. You don't get any of the variability of it. But I think the consequence of that variability is you are going to interact with them on a behavioral level, and you're going to react to their
big
behavior.
Picture.
So if you're stopping things every time they're painful, if you're overreacting when they say this hurts there, you're letting them lead the behavior. But
and you're feeding
you know,
into
you're,
it.
Yeah. And I'm not saying being callous. Sometimes people think that I'm lack empathy and all that, but I can tell you I had a great rapport with my patients, but I was very even 95% of the time because I kind of took the tact. If it freaks me out, what message does that send to them? And the 5% of the times I was freaking out was when I was like running a code at the hospital or someone's, you know, there are times to freak out, but it's not when someone comes in and says, my back pain's gone from 6 out of 10 to 8 out of 10. And I think it's because of the exercises you're having me do.
Okay. One quote that I took out of your Maley lecture, well, I took a bunch. I wrote a bunch of stuff down. But one that I hit rewind 2 or 3 times to make sure I wrote it down right, because I think it really sums up what the APTA's campaign is about, or the why to the what. And here's the quote. Misjudgment or failure to understand the nature and depths of pain can be associated with serious consequences, more pain and suffering for both individuals and society. And I think that's exactly what the APTA is getting at in terms of this Choose PT campaign and the opioid epidemic. Is somewhere along the lines, there was a pill and it took away the pain for a little while, so we just kept giving more pills. Why did you include that? What does that quote mean to you?
So that quote is not mine, first of all. We'll just let everyone know that. That quote was from the Institute of Medicine's Blueprint on Pain Relief in 2011. And those of us who are pain geeks in 2011 got this and kind of read through it and like, are we on the right path or are we on the wrong path? And that's from the preface. Mark Bishop and I pulled out a few quotes. We were starting to do some pain courses for the Brooks Fellowship over in Jacksonville. And we wanted to get some things to kind of get a reaction out of an audience. Because, you know, when you go talk to people about pain, you know, it doesn't have the urgency that it does now. And that quote, I thought, was supremely challenging to someone who worked clinically and has studied pain and was beginning to get a firm grasp on what the problem is. All of us pride ourselves in do no harm. And clearly, in pain, that hasn't been met when you look across the whole entire system. Like I said, I found it supremely challenging. I found it a little bit anger. Like I was a little bit mad about it. It motivated me. It provoked me. It's easy to look at opioids because they kill people or they cause addiction. And we need to be very careful as a profession that we don't say we're better than addiction and killing people. You know, we need to make sure we're finding our weaknesses where we're causing more suffering. It's just our side effects aren't as obvious.
Right.
But I do think our side effects are we probably overtreat people at times. You know, we're by overtreating one person, we're denying treatment to someone else who might be able to get our services. That part of us needs to be defined. Sometimes you think about when, like, why the hell am I doing this, right? You need to have a purpose. And that was one of the quotes that, you know, I thought, if I can help with this, then I'll have a purpose.
I think that was the quote that grabbed me because I like the ending. The ending really focuses, it's for the serious consequences, which is more pain and suffering for both individuals and society. And you see that a lot of times when you have patients who are in serious pain, and maybe that pain can lead to something even more serious like suicide. It's the understanding of healthcare professionals about pain is so important because in certain instances, it can be the difference between life and death. understanding it, which is how the quote begins. Misjudgment or failure to understand the nature and depths of pain can be associated with serious consequences. I think just understanding it, which is why, you know, there's someone like you who obviously who gets this because you studied it for so long. But I don't think that pain is this thing that we can cover in PT school in 10 minutes and understand it and move on. I think it's something that deserves more attention and time because it's a big deal.
Yeah, I agree. Think of all the bullshit that healthcare providers perpetuate about pain that is related to that misunderstanding. I mean, just think about how much misinformation is provided by people that are supposed to be caring
and informed.
Yeah, that is the part that makes me angry. People linking causes of pain to things that they shouldn't, that there's no scientific basis. And then, you know, the flip side of that is then people are saying, well, then there's no reason for it. And that's not the answer either. It's just that it is very complicated.
And you haven't figured that reason out yet.
Right. And you know
saying
what?
We don't really need to.
And we don't need to treat it. It's not this medical model where you have to identify the exact source, you know, culture it, and then create a antibiotic to kill it. There's probably some broad, important principles that are helpful. And those are very, very helpful. And we have some of them in our, and those are some of the things I talked about at the end of the lecture. You know, being able to be hands-on with pain seems to be really important. We sometimes get hung up on, you know, should we push right or left? Yeah, up or down. But providers that lay their hands and use their hands therapeutically do really well with pain. People that don't over-medicalize it do really well. And there are cases it needs to be medicalized. We're not in this situation now. The Choose PT campaign didn't come up because of too little medicalization of pain.
Right.
And again, I don't want to make sure, you know, there are times like if I have surgery, I'm accepting the perioperative pain.
Right.
Yeah. If I am in an accident, yes. But I think some of those principles have been misapplied because people think, well, it's pain. It's acute pain is the same as chronic pain is the same, you know. And so, yeah, I'm glad you got that quote, and hopefully it'll get under your skin a little bit too and bother you.
It did. I mean, I don't to the detriment of my my professors, I didn't take many notes. I was more of a listen and talk kind of guy, which is probably why I started a podcast. But for the fact that I made sure I rewound that lecture three times to make sure I got every word right and typed it out, that question did exactly what you just said. It got under my skin. It bothered me. I don't want to be that. I don't want to misjudge or fail to understand that nature and depth of pain. I don't want to do that. That's why
right.
I wrote that
Good.
One down. Something I should read to continue, since I'm now no longer a student. I'm about to be a paid physical therapist. How can I continue on my own? Who are some things you'd suggest to read? Who are some people out there with books or blogs or websites or anything? Papers?
You hit me in my weak spot. I don't the people that I work with make fun of me because I don't do a lot of social media stuff and blogging. In fact, we just had a big discussion about this. But I always tell people I'm neither social nor media inclined, so why should I do social media?
But what about books people that you when they come out with a paper that you go out of your way to make sure you read?
Lorimer Mosley has a pretty good website, and then you know, the European folks, Joe Nish's is at Pain in Motion. I spend most of my time in the peer review literature. For me, the people that inspire me with the research that they do, someone like a Mick Sullivan, who did the pain catastrophizing scale, and he has done some neat repetitive summation of movement paradigms that physical therapists, you know, that hasn't quite reached them yet. I remember talking to him at a conference, you know, whether I thought this was like different types of pain summation or not, because it was movement based. And I think these are the really interesting questions that PTs can answer. There's a group in the UK, Keel, they have osteoarthritis, and they're the group that did the Start Back tool. Jonathan Hill, Nadine Foster, Chris Main, you know, we pay attention to a lot of their work. The group in Australia at the George Institute, Chris Mayer's group, they have done 9-10 now really high impact trials published in Lancet or BMJ that I think have showcased some of the issues. I was lucky enough to be trained by Julie Fritz and Tony DeLito, so I usually pay attention to what they're doing. You know, the list can go on and on.
Well, you started by answering my question by saying, I don't really know, and then you wind up dropping a bunch of really, really big names. So I think my reading list has been started. Yeah, well, I think my reading list has been jump started now.
You can even search on some of the stuff we wrote too, if you get really bored after you finish all those. there are some. The books are a funny thing nowadays because I tend to access the peer review, but that's not to say there's not some excellent books. But I tend to read like science fiction or leadership books in my spare time instead of reading more about pain.
Well, what's one of those I should read too? Because now that I'm not a student anymore, I probably should have like some more of a social life and a little bit of downtime. So what's one good book on PT related that I could read?
Have you read a lot of Malcolm Gladwell's stuff?
A little bit. Tipping Point.
Yeah, I have read some of those. I'm reading Blink right now.
Blink. I've done Blink.
I started the nerd part of me, started the Wheel of Time series.
Yeah, yeah.
As a going away present, one of the research folks I work with got me one of Schwarzenegger's biops, so I'll put that one in the rotation. You know, just keep nice. Keep it moving around. Another good book, Nate Silver's Signal and Noise book. If okay. you haven't read that one, it really is looking at different ways of handling variability. Mm-hmm. One of the things that drives me absolutely crazy: we have more sophisticated models for predicting who's going to be in the Major League Baseball playoffs than we do for healthcare outcomes. So that.
Yeah. It's not good.
You know, that's something I'd like to apply. I mean, part of it is because they just have so much damn data and it's easy to collect. But
right. I've repeated it wasn't my thought. I'd like to live in a world where a Nobel Prize winner gets as much recognition as the guy who wins the MVP in the American League. That'd be a great world to live in, wouldn't it?
It would.
So every episode we do is a pint. And before we're done with the pint, we take shots. So one parting shot of wisdom for the field of physical therapists. What's one little nugget that you usually give to people if you only got one chance to give them something before they leave? What's one thing you say, you know what, keep this close to the vest and don't forget it?
Oh, man, that's tricky. I thought the pain is behavior was kind of that one. It's a balance between don't overvalue the specific things that you do with the patient at the cost of the overall interactions. But it really is a fine balance, because I also hate it when we go to a psychologically informed practice thing and someone tells me, so all I have to do is be nice to the person and they'll get better.
Right, right.
Because I think that's bullshit too. I really do. Like, I think the people who are really skilled are the people that can read the nuances of the psychosocial interactions. But also, we have some things that we can provide patients that do physiologically alter and offer better outcomes. And I think the combination of those two is really powerful. But I think sometimes, you know, therapists start chasing down too much of the specificity. I have to have the right perfect setting for this to work and da da da, and at the expense of the interaction. But then some people kind of go too general and just say, well, I'm just going to be nice to them. You know, all these studies say it doesn't matter whether I plug in this machine or not. And I hate to see that too, because one of those is a skilled provider and the other one is not. And I think that would be my
I like that.
Nugget is
don't go all one way. Yeah, I like that. Good balance.
Yeah, and I think that's really important for pain, because PTs are going to drift into the space and we're going to have a lot of people that all of a sudden are experts on it. And some of them may be and some of them aren't. But one of the surefire ways to find out if someone isn't is if they always have the answer to this, you know, if they can simplify it and say, well, this is what I do with every patient, you know, that I have. And I get those emails too. What's funny is my PhD students get more mad about them now than I do, because I'm just like, this is just the way the world works.
Right.
People like to think there's a absolute answer out
there. A way, a definitive way.
Yeah.
I like that. I'm going to keep that close to the vest when I start my work next week as a physical therapist. It's weird. I actually get to go be a PT now.
Who Great. Knew? Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
Appreciate your time. Really, really enjoyed your lecture. We're going to put a link so people can check it out. If you weren't able to be in Great. Attendance online at ptpinecast.com, just click on the blog and we'll have it in the episode chaser. And hope this isn't the last time we talk. We'll definitely want to hear you your experiences now that you're going over to Duke.
Yeah, definitely. We can catch up again in a little bit and fill you in on what's going on here in North Carolina, and we can see how things are going and pain and whatnot.
Sounds good. Steve George in the PT Pinecast. Steve, again, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Follow us on Twitter at PT Pinecast and online at ptpinecast.com. It's like TMZ, except with way more important information and no Miley Cyrus. Okay, it's not like TMZ at all. The PT Pinecast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that.